Think, good night.
Non parlo, è partito, perfetto.
Okay. È partito? Sì, che ormai lo taglio. Sì. E va là, giusto? Che cosa sta proiettando qui? Forse qua c'è bisogno di...
Perché il fatto che sono tutti quelli là insieme è molto difficile
da capire qual è che è. No,
perché, no, però sto facendo vedere quelli.
Sì. Quindi c'è un cavo che è collegato a quello lì.
Questo qua è il tuo, si collega.
Magari c'è uno switch.
Eccolo, qualcosa è successo. Attaccato tutto.
Ah, ok. Perfect. Ok, work. Ok, so here we are. So I heard that there were some questions related to the Mahler's computation and their use, so what they are used for. So the first thing, and how you choose the correct model of computation for a particular domain of application. So why there are so many models of computation? Because each model of computation is the result of a trade-off between how general the model of computation is, so how well it represents the problem on one side, on the other side how fast you can analyze it with simulation, or how analyzable it is from formal method, third axis, and then the fourth and last axis is how synthesizable it is. So is there a path that takes from that description into an implementation? So these are the three major aspects. So now if you take finite state machines, the good thing about finite state machines, of course we know it's finite state, so it's a limited number of potential behaviors. They represent very well the actual decision making that goes on when you are controlling a process. The advantage is that it's fully analyzable, so you can ask any kind of question and it can be answered. From implementation point of view, it's also simple to do. It is synthesizable because finite state machines are easy to implement because you have a transition. Essentially what you need to do is you need to implement a storage mechanism and then you have to implement a next state function that takes this, the bits of the state and generates the next state. So finite state machines in fact are very much liked and used models, both for hardware and software. Now the drawback is that if indeed you want to represent asynchrony in some sense, so if you want to represent things that don't need to synchronize, and again, finite state machine in general is are not concurrent models of computation per se. So one finite state machine is not concurrent. Now, if you want to model concurrency, you have to use multiple finite state machines, right? And the point is that if you connect them in a synchronous model, then what happens is that the finite state machines are equivalent to a single finite state machine, and that single finite state machine may be very large, because in general, in combining a number of finite state machines, they are equivalent to a finite state machine whose number of states is the product of the states of a single finite state machine. So you have an exponential blow up. The other good thing is that finite state machines are hierarchical, and then you get yet to another variation of finite state machines that are called hierarchical finite state machines, but they are still equivalent to a single finite state machine. So all of these properties, like for example concurrency, hierarchy, and so on, are good for the user in the sense that you have a shorthand description of what your process looks like. But indeed, when it comes to analysis, you still have the explosion problem. So you cannot implement, for example, a hierarchical finite state machine. You have to flatten it out. Okay, so that's what is good about finite state machines. Now, how fast they do simulate? Well, you can make them simulate fast, but not as fast as other things. Okay. Now, the other model computation that you have seen was data flow, right? Data flow is also a pretty general model of computation. It is represented by actors, and actors connect up with each other with directed arcs that express the input-output relationship, so they implement causality. So now, the good thing about data flow is that it is a concurrent model. So if you think about the way in which each actor behaves, you can easily represent things that go in parallel or concurrently by not putting any arcs, right? They just go on their own pace, right? Now, the to represent causality, you have the arc, great. And the great property is that it is, in principle, an asynchronous model. There is no reason why everything should go at the same speed, right? It's not intrinsic in the model itself. Now, how good are they from property analysis? It depends. If you have a so-called synchronous data flow machine, that which I rather would call static data flow machines, then they are fully analyzable. So, you know, they're schedulable. If you have deadlocks, anything you want to know, you can do. The other thing is that in this particular subclass of data flow, you can also implement, quote-unquote, you can simulate this thing extremely fast. There is no other model that can simulate this fast, because you can do a static schedule, which means that you can generate loopless code that execute that. And so you cannot go any faster than that. And it is compact because you don't need to flatten anything, right? So it's fantastic, beautiful, all the way. Now, how many things can be represented with a static or synchronous data flow? Not many. They're not so general. And so you have all kind of variation of data flow. You have Boolean data flow, and you have CAN process networks, and so on, which are fantastic, very general. Unfortunately, analysis is a problem. You can't say much about, you know, the Boolean data flow, for example. They are Turing complete, so too bad. But they are nice, nevertheless, to capture the nature of the problem itself. Now, in fact, it's interesting to notice that there are very, very few, if any, tool in the world that actually leverage this this model of computation. And it's so strange, because it would be fantastic to have this model of computation to represent things, because it can go very fast, right? So now, I said almost none. There was one, it's called SPW, that was indeed executing data flows. And so that was going pretty damn fast. But the point is that was going very fast only with static data flow. Okay, so that is for data flow. Now, we see immediately that, for example, if you use concurrent finite state machines, you have a problem that everything has to go in synchrony, so they have to move at the same speed, or better said, that you execute then you wait until you communicate, end communication, execute, stop, communicate, execute, communicate. Now, when people think about synchronicity, many people, especially those of you who are used to hardware, they think that synchronicity equals clock. Right? Is that really true? I already said it a few weeks ago, but is that really true? Do you need a clock for synchrony or not? For synchrony is an abstract thing. Of course, no, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't pose that thing, right? And so what it means is that, and you will see when you will do synchronous languages, that would be next week. Synchronous languages are a particular, yet another model of computation which has synchronicity in it. But when you look at synchronous languages, they talk about logic clocks, right? Which is a misnomer again. Nothing to do with clock at all, right? And so the clock means that there is some kind of process that every so many seconds or milliseconds or microseconds or nanoseconds, whatever, right? On any so many time units, that's something, okay? So it gives a trigger so that you can do communicate or you can do compute. Right? So that's what the clock does. But the model of computation simply says that there are two phases, one compute, one communicate, one compute, one communicate, one compute, one communicate. That's it. And they don't overlap. So it can take, you know, one compute can take 200 million years. It's not captured by the model at the more abstract level. It simply says compute. Now, communication can take 1 nanosecond. Fine, you know. And then the next communication can take 1 hour. Fine. So the point is that it says that all the operation of a synchronous model has to occur lining up actions. Lining up actions. That's the reason why it's also called logical time. But logical time has this notion of time that in an abstract sense doesn't make any sense. There is no time. Right? Is a logical abstraction. So this is very important to keep in mind. Now, when you implement this model of computation into a chip, then all of a sudden there is the problem how you make sure that things line up. Right? And gates take time, and this gate is faster than this gate, and this computation takes less time than this computation. So how do we line up these things? Then we use the clock. And so the clock is simply saying, as long as the clock doesn't go, you keep on computing and writing the latch, right, the memory. Right? When the clock comes in, you better have valid data, so everything has to be settled down. And then the computation is correct. Now, so the design problem from hardware implementation point of view is to make absolutely sure that every time that the clock ticks, everything has been done. Right? Now, at this point, everything lines up because the clock that lines everything up. But then with the correctness of the implementation is saying any path between one latch and the next has to take a time less than the clock time. Okay? Otherwise, it will have invalid data. Okay? Now, the introduction of synchronous models in hardware has been a major factor in making us able to build gigantic chips, right? Because we don't have to worry about race conditions and these kind of things that you don't know what this data means, right? So, on the other hand, it's right now we have a serious problem to line things up. Why is that? Well, because there must be an object that does the job of a clock, right? In general, we have a specific circuitry that issue the clock signal, right? But if we want that everything lines up, you have to have a notion of time, the same as you, same as you, same as you, same as you, and so on, right? Unfortunately, in the chips of today, the relative distance between him and him is so large that when I send the signal, there is a skew, and that's the famous clock skew, right? So that he receives the clock signal before he does, then what? Scratch, scratch, scratch. So a lot of the design issues is that I should put additional delay between me and him so that the two guys get the clock at the same time. Otherwise, we run the risk of not having the correct implementation of my logic. There are other ways and other tricks that I will tell you later on, in which you can quote-unquote desynchronize things and still keep the same, the equivalence of a behavior. Then in that sense, we can free a bit the implementation side and yet get all the good stuff of synchronous design. Okay? Now, this thing is the same when you have a car, for example, you have a synchronous implementation of a controller. Now, the problem is about issuing the clock, quote-unquote, on a bus, right? That's the same problem, right? You have skews and stuff like that, so you've got to worry about the same kind of issue. So, which is once more my input to you, that the design problems are the same always, right? Doesn't matter if you design in the small or you design in the large. The units are different, because when you design in the large, you may talk about seconds sometimes. When you design in the small, you may talk about nanoseconds, but all the rest is absolutely the same. So why? Because the original description of what I want to do, of my problem, is the same in both cases. Right? And so the implementation then have to be somewhat related to each other, and the issue then, how do I make sure that my implementation reflects what I want to do in the first place, right? And so even though synchronicity has been a great thing in the past to make very complex design possible, it has a problem, intrinsic problem. One is distribution of inputs of the signal. The second one, though, is the fact that if we want to line up everything, right, so maybe that is very fast, right, it goes very quickly and does this computation in 1 nanosecond, and is very slow, it takes 4 nanoseconds, right, so, well, he has to wait until he's done, right, so what happens is that certain parts of the design have to wait, right, so it's wasteful, right, so one way that designers do is try to even out, so to push down his timing as much as possible at the expense maybe of his time, right? So to even up. Now, is that an easy thing to do? Not necessarily, right? Now, when you get away from the synchronous hypothesis, then, in principle, I could have him compute at his speed, him at his speed, independently. Now, data flow do this, by the way. Data flow is intrinsically capable of handling him going very fast and him going very slow. But the synchronous models don't. And so that is another problem with synchronicity. And in fact, if you read the literature of the last 10, 15, 20 years, you find a lot of papers, including many that we wrote, in which we say, well, gee, if we were able to design asynchronously guaranteeing properties, it would be much better. Right? And so there is all this papers that talk about asynchronous design, and there are companies, lots of startups that started doing asynchronous design. How many of these are still alive? Zero. All dead. Why? Because people got so much used to the design and synchronous way that every time someone comes up and say, why don't you try to do asynchronous, they say, go away. It's too complicated. Even though you say, it's not, because I got this tool that is capable of coping with any problem or any difficulty, you don't have to worry. They worry, right? And so end of story. But in principle, in fact, we will see when I'm going to talk to you about desynchronization that you can still maintain all the good stuff at the functional side of synchronous design, but not being tied to the implementation to be synchronous, right? So but one of the major problems of system level design is that people tie too much the functionality to the implementation of the functionality. And so they force to go with the same models, with the same everything, instead of asking for equivalence. Not the same, equivalence. That's what the name of the game is, but not the same. Anyway, so this one of the reasons why you have all these different models is because you are trying to do the best you can with the model you have to represent what you want to do, trading off the various dimensions that I was talking about before. Now, most of the simulation tools that you have around, interestingly enough, are asynchronous, right? So I say Scratch, how come? You know, all the implementation are synchronous and all that simulation is asynchronous. Well, because simulation doesn't have to be the same as, you know, it's not an implementation. It is, by the way. But why it is? Because essentially it is the mapping of your functionality onto a particular solution space, which is the damn thing, right? Which is the computer, right? And so what you do is that you do solve the mapping problem and all of that, but having a single processor, pre-designed memory and everything. So in fact, the name of the game of the guys who are writing simulation code is to extract as much speed as you can from that machine with respect to the models that you want to simulate in the first place. And so you find that, you know, it's a gazillion dollars that go around, right? I mean, simulation business is a big business, so being fast is a very good thing, right? And so people try their best to accelerate simulation, but most of them of the simulators are asynchronous to try to do as fast as possible execution. So even synchronous systems are implemented asynchronously on the processor itself. Now, then we come to another interesting model. It's called PetriNet. PetriNet actually is by a German guy, Carl Albert Petri, I think that was his name, C.A. Petri, who is has invented 1963. This model of computation, because he found that there are certain things that finite state machines and data flow don't model well. And so this model actually has been used everywhere to represent especially large systems. And what it is used is to represent things where there is a certain degree of non-determinism, so things that you don't know how they are going to go, and there is an element of decisions that are data dependent. Right? So PetriNet are good at that kind of stuff. And so let's see how they look like and what they do. So, and what kind of things you can do. Actually, 62. Okay. Was a PhD thesis. Pretty good, actually. So the application is everything, distributed computing, manufacturing, control, communication networks, transportation. And so they explicitly represent sequencing and causality, conflict, non-deterministic choice, and concurrency. So they actually do everything that a finite state machine and a data flow do in the same model. So the basic PN model is an asynchronous model, so partial ordering as a data flow. The main drawback of these guys is that non-hierarchical. So there are lots of papers that have been written recently that talk about hierarchical PetriNet, but they're not really hierarchical in some sense, because the model itself has to be flat because of a decision that are taken, I mean, because of a representation of the decision process and so on. So we'll give you a couple of examples, but let me switch out, and I found a very nice on the web, a very nice animation that I want to show you.
So do you mean by a non-hierarchical that PetriNet, if I were to compose them, or non-compositional,
you don't always... No. Hierarchical means that you don't have, you know, for example, a hierarchical finite state machines means that each state is actually another finite state machine. Okay? So when you enter that state, you actually executing another finite state machine. So that kind of nesting is not possible. So think of hierarchy as about nesting. Now, composition has nothing to do with hierarchy. Okay, so this is an elevator, what you see here. And what you want to do is to represent the elevator. Now, why the elevator is kind of interesting? Because, again, you know that which floor is going to get to depends on who is pushing the button, right? So you may go from the first floor to the second floor, back to the first floor, or you can go to the third floor, and so on and so forth. So how do you represent this? So you see three tokens on three black dots on the first node, and these black dots represent the number of floors. And then you have two square things that are labeled by plus one and minus one. Now, what does plus 1 minus 1 mean is that it means that it goes up one floor or down one floor. So you have one more or one less floor to go. So let's see what happens. So I click the button and boom, you see? Then you have one button, so it means that I went to the second floor, then push it again. It means that I gain another floor, I get there, another one, I get to the top. And now once I am on the top floor, then if I push this one, you see every time a token gets eaten up by this node here, I go one level down. And of course, I mean, I can get this block here, and then I can do minus one here, which means that I'm going to go back at floor zero, right? So there are many ways in which this execution can go. So you see that there are two kind of nodes in this operation. So one node that represents the state of the state of the system, which is this round node, and the other one which represents what happens, which are called transitions. So there are two nodes, two kind of nodes. One are called places, which is where the token gets stored, and other, which are the square blocks. And we see that actually they are represented like bars, but in this particular case the graphics was is better with the because of the animation. It's represented by a square node, which tell you what happens when you go from one place to the next one, so from one state to the next, if you like. Okay, so I'll show you yet another interesting diagram, and this one is another representation of the same elevator. Now this one has got more places, and its representation is another Petri net, where actually the token, instead of representing the floor, it represents the elevator. Now you notice that there are more nodes, and so it depends on the way in which you represent the behavior of the system, you may have more or less nodes. So, and how does this move? So if you click on this, so you have the ground floor, so you click on this, then the token gets transmitted here, which means you are a second floor. Now you can go back to the first floor, or you can go back at the second floor, and so on. So notice that when I have this token here, the P3 at the second floor, I have two choices. I can go up one, or I can go down one. And so what it says is that in that round node, if I have outgoing arcs, is a choice. I can take one arc or I can take the other one. I cannot take both, right? Either one, but not both. That's the reason why I represent choice. Now, why do I need to represent that as a choice? Because I don't know. It depends on the guy who's pushing the button, right? It can go up and down. And so this model is representing all the possible behavior of the plane. of the elevator. Now, why do I want to represent the elevator this way? So what kind of question may I ask about this? So the first question is that, does the elevator keep on moving? Or does it get stuck somewhere, right? If it gets stuck somewhere, it means that my design is wrong, right? Because it doesn't go up or down, it's dead, right? And so that's one question that you may want to ask. This particular case, probably the only one. Oh, another one is say, do I always make it to the third floor? Right? So in other words, all the places here are reachable. So am I sure that I can go to any floor or not? So these are the two basic questions that I can ask about this thing. So the issue then, does a method exist that gives me this answer? I mean, do I reach everything? Do I get stuck somewhere? And the answer is yes. And for some class of Petri nets, this is possible and is actually very convenient. So let me. Yes? Yeah, they're equivalent. Just the way the kind of things you want to represent. Right? So the way in which you want to give insight to the. To the people who are observing your design. So, now this one is actually a PetriNet, which represent an assembly line, right? So the, you have a bag of parts which are available to you, and you see that the black dot means the presence of a particular set of parts. Now, suppose that I don't have any ears, I cannot execute the first block over there, because I have no ears, so I cannot add ears, which are these things, to the assembly process. So this this node, this black dot, represents the availability of parts in the assembly line. Okay, and the assembly line will form a particular phase. Okay, so suppose that we start. So the node to the left is simply saying start. Okay, so at the starting, I have now two square nodes that represent potential transitions. Now the one on top, it says head inventory, so it means that I can pull out a head from the inventory and move to the next place where I'm going to have the assembly with the head. The one down there, it says I have available ears, and so in the next node, I'm going to see the ears that are available to me to build the face. Now, you see that there are two yellow boxes in there. What does that mean? That both these transitions can be executed concurrently, right? There is no arc between them. You can take any one of the two. So this is a choice. So what do you want? The one on top or the one on the bottom? Doesn't matter, but just tell me one. So we'll click on that one.
Why are there only two available?
Because the if you look, okay, this one is part of the model that I was going to indicate, but the fact is when you can take the transition is when you have enough token at the input so that you can fire. It's the same thing as data flow. So I can move on my assembly line only if I started the token on the left, which is always going to be on, and I have a head in my bag of tricks. If that is available, then I can build the head. I can pick up the head. In here, if I have ears in my inventory, I can pick them up and move, right? If I have no ears, I'm stuck, so I cannot execute that. And in fact, if you look at, for example, that white square over there, I don't have a smile, right? I don't have a smile. I don't have the smile is up there. I don't have that white node. There is no token there, right? So I have one element missing, and so I cannot do it because I don't have one thing available to me. Okay, so that's the way in which you decide what you can do. Is all the transitions that can fire are the one with the tokens in the right place, like data flow. No difference here. No difference. So you can choose either one of them, and so that's exactly the same as in data flow. That's good. So let's pick up the top one. Okay, suck. And so now you have selected the head, which moves to the right, which is an assembled part. Now, you may say, I can take the one there or the one up there. The answer is no, because you see that you have two arcs going from the bottom to the top, which means that I have to have two tokens. And so I cannot take my transition with the red cross because I don't have enough tokens. So at this point, I can only fire one transition. And the one transition I can fire is to add one ear to the ears that are available for me to move on. So I'll click on that, and bingo, I'm going to go to the next. Check. Now I have available hair and ears, and so I can take the next transition. Notice that that transition is okay because I have everything there. I have the head that has been assembled already. I have hair in my inventory, which is the left box, and I have 2 ears available to me. So when I take the transition, I'm going to add the hair and the ears to the head. And so, cluck, boom. Okay? Now the next thing I have now on the left the hair, the ears, and the head. And I come to that yellow node. Now I have three tokens, so I can execute all the arcs at their appropriate token. I have a smile and a nose, so I can do that. I can move on, and I can take that. And guess what? I'm going to have the face, which is becoming more visible. So. And then the last is when I add two eyes. You see, I have two tokens, so which means I have two eyes available to me. Pop, and this is the end. Now, this one is a simple problem, but you can actually represent very complex assembly lines. So in many tools that you have for scheduling of automotive lines, this is exactly what you see. And so the operators use this diagram to decide what is the sequence of operation that your assembly line is going to do. Now, this thing, this kind of representation is also used to represent operating systems. Why? Because again, it's the choice of what process I'm going to let go. And then if I am going to let process A go versus process B, if I issue an interrupt and so on, can be all represented this way. So this is, as I said before, is a very interesting and useful model of computation. Well, then I mean we can go also to a more complex. Let's see. Let me go to the philosophers. So this you know the philosophers that are sitting around the table and they can do two things, either eat or think. Unfortunately, there are only a certain number of forks available, so and they cannot eat and think at the same time. And so the question is that how do you represent this? Now this one, each one of the philosophers has a Peternet model which represents the fact that you either think or eat, but not both. Now when you assemble the two, and okay, so which is this here? Okay, so this is actually the four philosophers sitting at the table, and the dots that you see in the table are the forks available. So you can enable the transition eat only if you have the token on the table. So if you don't have the token in the table, you cannot eat. Right? And so now you can see how this model progresses.
You have one token, but
where you which one?
Now,
in fact, either you can either have TE1 or TE4 eat, but not both, because the fork is 1, and so that is the choice. So it's like you have a fork here, so you go or she goes, right? And that is the trick. That's the reason why you use the Peternet, because you don't know which one is going to take the fork. And that represents that, conflict. Okay, that's what I want. That conflict of the use of the resource. And then when you are finished eating, you see that there is an arc which brings the token back to the table. And so when I think, I put down the token so the other guy can eat. And so let's take, for example, this transition here. Now this is the, you see that this fork has disappeared. And you do like this, now you're back to the situation where the four forks are in there. And so you repeat it again. So at this time you see that all the philosophers are in the position of thinking, nobody is eating, so there are the four forks are sitting on the table. So, and again, the fact that you brought up how come the two arcs, that's exactly the point of using Peternet, because it models this conflict on the use of resources. And of course the behavior of this Peternet depends on the guy who decides to go. So if you do this, you see that you have a different behavior of the system, because you have decided that the philosopher T3 is going to eat. Okay.
So when you put on the transition,
right?
You were saying that he
let's consume the token. Right. Yeah.
So So two tokens disappear from the table.
Yeah, because you need the two instruments for you to be capable of eating. Right.
One fork and one knife.
Right. One fork and one knife. Sorry, I said all forks. You need both, right? And so that's the reason why to go away. So you have a fork and a knife. So you are preventing the philosopher's fork from eating because the fork is missing, and you are preventing it to eat because the knife is missing. Okay. And so, well, you can have fun, you know, like this one, and the two philosophers are eating. Then decide what you want. You can do this, and then this is available. So now these two can start and eat, and so on. So this one represents a large number of behaviors in a compact way. Okay, so it's Petrinet. Okay, so we saw what are the basic principle. This one is another model in which there is a train that comes to a single lane track, and so the train wants to go to the right, the train entering the track from the left, and train going to the right, and then the train eventually leave the track to the right. Now, the point is that the train actually enter the track from the left if the track is available. If there is another train there, it cannot go there. And so again, you see that there are these two tokens, the track is available and the train wants to go to the right, then you can go in, right? And on the bottom is the opposite transition where the train wants to go to the left, and the track is available, can do it, otherwise you cannot do it. So this one is actually, if you go to the way in which people design traffic light controllers, this is it. So they use Petrinet actually to design traffic light controllers. If you have sensors to see if the cars are there or not, so there are the more complex view of traffic light controllers use Petrinet to schedule the thing. So. You know, you can only take the transition when the two arrows correspond to round nodes with the token in it. Okay.
Correspond to round nodes.
Round nodes. So you see that the black dot is in the round node that says track is available,
uh-huh.
And the one it says the train is present and it wants to go to the right. So since the track is available, then the train can go onto the.
What about like those rectangles?
Rectangular, two tokens. Right. Right. So it exits and goes to that, and it goes to the track available because it's gone out from the track. Now the track is available again. Okay. So, and if you have two, if you have another train sitting in there, then you have all of a sudden you have another token which says there is another train, and this train wants to go to the left. Now you have the track available, you see the two arcs up and down, that is a choice, you know. So you can let the train to the right or the train to the left to use the track. But there is no a priori reason why one or the other should be given. But the point is that it's exclusive. Once you consume the token for letting this train to go to the left, it's not available for the train up to take the track. Right? It has been used. So that resource is not available. Okay. So now we can formalize all of this, and this one is the actual formalized view. This is a graphical representation of everything. Instead of having the rectangular box or the square box, now you have this thing, this vertical bar, which is the way in which Petri represented it, but the same thing. So it's a bipartite graph, meaning that places can only be connected to transition, and transition can only be connected to places. You cannot have two places, one after the other. You cannot have two transitions, one after the other. You always have to have a place between the two. So places are represented with circle, and transition are either bars or boxes. We saw the box representation before because it's easier to do the animation, all that, but Petri used this vertical bar. The arcs can be labeled with weight. So instead of having two arcs, you can add one arc and then two, which means that there are two objects that go along this arc. So this one is a Petri net. You have these two tokens. And so now you have to decide what is the next, what is fireable, so what is the next state, right? So now, remember, this is a choice. So this token can go to the left or can go to the right, but not to both places, okay? So now, if we go to the right, what happens is that it enables this transition, and then three tokens are generated, and they go into P4. Okay, that's the meaning of this. Now, is this transition fireable or not? No, why? You need a token in P2, right? So it cannot be. So this thing, you have to take, the only fireable transition is this one, right? So we will take this one, we get three tokens there, then we have to use two tokens to generate one token in P2. Now, can we move on? And can we fire this transition? Actually, no, because this is gone, right? And so this Petri net gets stuck, doesn't move, right? And so this has a deadlock, right? Which is one of the questions that we said before. So, okay. So now, a Petri net, then, is a set of nodes, which are, again, the transition and the places, and a set of arcs which have weights or not, and then M0. What is M0? This is a dynamical system, right? It moves and changes and evolves. So you need an initial state, and that initial state is called M0. Now, what is M0? Is the initial distribution of tokens in the network. So M0 at this point says that there is a token here and there is a token there. How do you represent the initial condition, quote-unquote? The initial condition is represented by a vector that has as many elements as the places, and it tells me, for every entry in the vector, how many tokens are available in that place. So this one would be a vector with four entries, the M0, represented by these two, and how is it going to look like? This vector?
1, 0, 1.
Perfect. 1, 0, 1, 0. So one, P1 has got one token, P2 has got zero token, P3 has got one token, and P4 has got zero token, right? Assume that we take the transition, and let's see, what is the M that corresponds to this? So this one generates three tokens here. So let's look at this one. So we got one token in P1 and three token in P4. So how is that going to look like? The vector of state. 1, 0, 0, 3. Okay, so that's the state. Right? So now notice that this one is very similar to a state transition situation, and that the state of a Petri net corresponds to the distribution of dots in the places. Right? So in some sense, this model does subsume finite state machines. But the state is not any of the nodes or anything like that. It's the position of the token in the network. That is the state of the network. Okay. And it's called a marking. And again, places and transition are conditions and represent conditions and events. Next one, okay. So a marking is changed according to the following rules. The transition is enabled if there are enough tokens in each input place. An enabled transition may or may not fire, as we know, right? We have a choice which one we want to fire or not. The firing of a transition modifies the marking by consuming the token in the input, so the places get decreased by the number of tokens that the transition needs, and by increasing the tokens in the output of the transition. So in this particular case, we got a token in the top node, we got two tokens in the bottom node. At this point, only one transition is enabled, which is that one. And so, since the arc on the output of that transition carries the weight 2, the next state is going to have only two tokens in this node, and that's the end of it. Now, we cannot take this transition here because it's only two tokens. So here there is no choice. I just have to take one transition. So it's no choice. Now, if I started with three tokens here, I would have a decision to make. I could fire this guy, or I could fire that guy. Both of them were available. Right? And so if I take to fire the top guy, then I would take away two tokens, and it would be only one token here, and then I will get one token there. End of story. Right? Now, you see that in this particular case, I don't have a choice because I don't have three tokens there. And so that makes my behavior deterministic. In the other case, non-deterministic, because I could have taken two different places. Now, these models can represent concurrency, obvious, causality, so one thing before the other, like data flow, and choice. And so the top PetriNet is an obvious concurrency in the sense that T1 and T2 can both fire, right, in parallel. There is no causality link between the two transition indicated there, and so that represents concurrent behavior. So there is no relation between what goes on top. Okay, so I can have the two which actually execute in parallel at the same time. Now the one on the bottom represent a sequencing in the sense that that transition simply says that the place here between T3 and T4 has to follow the situation that we had before. That's the only thing that this particular representation implies. So there is a sequencing of operations. So it means that the transition T4 is causally related, to T3. It has to execute only after T3 has been executed. So that is what this particular representation means. And when you take T4, now you have a choice of conflict because we have a token available that can be consumed either by T5 or T6, but not both. Is a choice that you have to make. Or if you like, there is a conflict in the use of this resource.
Is there a difference between sequencing and causality in this context?
No, it's the same. So in some sense, if you really think about causality, that's what it means. Right? One thing has to follow the other. So sequencing and causality, in my view, they are synonyms.
Okay. So,
you know, there is one, just one, there is indeed, there is only one small difference in the sense that causality in our mind means that I caused this to happen, right? And sequencing means this has to come before the other. It doesn't necessarily cause it, right? So it is a philosophical difference or interpretation, but the way in which you represent it is exactly the same. So it is just the semantics of it, right? So for example, if I slap Alberto here, you can slap me back, right? That's a causality, so because, right? And sequencing is that if I put this my fork here, then he takes it, but I don't cause him to take this.
Yes.
Right, it's sequence. Yes.
So if there are two tokens in this node,
which?
And the node that we're discussing right now, the one where there is currently a choice of conflict.
Right.
So if there are two tokens,
there are three different ways. So you can have one token T5 and then the other token T6. I can have T6 and then T5. I can have T5 and T6 together, And since I have two tokens, you know, I can, all combinations are all possible.
But we don't distinguish between the tokens themselves.
No.
And so, how does this capture the data-driven behavior?
Well, the data-driven is because data is not here, right? So it means that this one represents the set of all possible behavior of the thing, no matter what the data is. Now, you can say that there is another element somewhere here that is going to say, take this, take that. But I don't know where it is. So that's the reason why you have non-determinism, right? It's to represent things that you don't know, right? And so in this case, I don't know. Can either one of these can depend, and there may be some decision maker that is in another plane that is saying, take this, take that, right? But if this decision maker is an environment, right, then this is represents my design, and I want to be able to say that no matter what the environment does, if it wants to go up or down, my design is safe, it's, you know, doesn't deadlock, blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
Right?
So this puts in a context of a paper I read some time ago, not having understood what feature names are, and now it makes sense how they, what they were using.
Good.
Because
so
they,
I was
yeah, well, they were using feature nets to describe C software.
Uh-huh.
And are there current, you know, states that you can reach, you know, bad states, etc., which is undecidable for C. But by abstracting away the data, not caring what the conditions are, just knowing you can split one way or the other, they abstracted that away from the language, and then that decision.
And then you're there. But you see, yeah, depends, right? So you may still be undecided, even if you abstract it this way. So it depends on the structure of the data in it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So there are some paper nets that are decidable, others that are not. So, yes.
For the first graph, right, unconnected, so concurrency
yes.
and Abernino.
Right.
So for the second case,
yes.
In the beginning, the last most critical has two tokens.
Yes.
The one going to the center, so can C3 and C4 both happen at the same time?
So yes, they could.
Okay.
They could. So because there is no connection, right? So it can go both this way,
yeah.
Right? Because this place is vacated, so I can go in there. Right?
Yeah.
So they can happen, quote unquote, in the same time. Okay. So it's quite. I mean, in this particular case, is not. I mean, it is concurrency, but it is not explicitly represented as such. Concurrency is in general is represented by this independent path, right? But you're right. I mean,
it's
could
like
be
a pipeline, right? So
yeah, it is a pipeline.
Yeah,
you're right. It is a pipeline. It depends on the distribution of tokens. So while the one on top is always concurrent, no matter how the tokens are distributed,
yeah.
The one below is a pipeline. So only if there is data here, you can say that it's concurrent.
So if I understand your question correctly, you're saying that the valid execution could include two tokens.
But move together,
move together.
So you have the first token goes here, now you have a situation where it's token here and token there. Then he says, can I say that both these transitions are taken at the same time? In principle, yes. But it doesn't really matter, you know, it doesn't change, because the fact that you take this first or that first, or you take it this first and then the other, there's only one thing that is impossible, and it is that you take this before that. Right. All the rest is in material, right? Well, that's the equivalent. Yes.
Is there a choice when two transitions can fire at the same time? Can you choose to have one of them fire and the other one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the model allows you any decision, both at the same time, this first, that first.
Then wouldn't the markings that come afterwards depend
yeah.
on how you choose?
Yeah, of course. Right. Because we will see that one of the representation of the operation of this thing is what is called the reachability tree. It says all the possible places that I can go to, right? And so that gives you the power of the representation. Yes.
Do the tokens have any meaning other than just being used for scheduling? Like, for example, is it like a package of data they're passing this into?
They're called colored petri nets. And so a colored petri net, the token is not simply indicating the presence or absence, but it can also represent the value, right? So So you can have, I don't know, packet 12222 or packet 0101. So you can append to the token this information. Then it become colored Peterinet. Some more complex Peterinet. So you can do that if you want. But you get into trouble, right? Because they're more complicated, you know.
I think there's some tokens that you just destroy space.
At
one point they are like 2, at another point they are like 3.
Sure. They can be, in fact, you know, very good. So what can happen in here? What can happen in a Peterinet, right? You can have a all of a sudden, you know, they keep on going, then all of a sudden there is no more token, right? So like we saw before. That means that the Peterinet is not alive. So it's up there, right? The other situation is there is a deadlock. There's a deadlock when there are no transition that can be generated, but you have token set up. And then the last possible situation is when you have unbounded Peterinet. What does that mean? Token, right? They keep on being generated, and then at some point you have a bag so full of token, you know, infinite token. We'll see that we can say if the Peterinet is unbounded, there's deadlock, and so on and so forth. Now, can we give necessary and sufficient conditions? Sometimes we can, sometimes we cannot. Sometimes we can give necessary conditions, sometimes we can give sufficient conditions. And so now this model is amazingly rich, so you can do all kind of things on it, and you can ask all kind of questions. So, which is next topic on the class, okay? But it's very good because you exactly are pointing out all the issues and problems with this model. So far, you have extracted everything. So you already exposed all the issues with Peterinet. So we can go now. Now we have to say how you answer the question. So this one is another use of Peterinet. It's very much used for communication protocols. So represent communication protocols. This one is a communication protocol. Let's say you send a message, then the message is received, is work upon, then you have to send an acknowledgement. When you receive the acknowledgement, then you can go on and generate another transmission. So it's a typical communication protocol. So when you go through that transition, we say that when, as I said, you said it everything, right? So when there are two arcs coming out of a transition, you generate two tokens, one goes there and the other goes over there. Now you have how many transitions are enabled here? One or two? One. Perfect. Then one to the right, then one to the left. No, because we have not received acknowledgement as yet. Right. So keep on going. Check, check, check. Flop. Then you do this. Then you do that. Now the receiver knowledge has been done, so you can move on. You go here and you start back again. Now, did someone see something interesting here? Yeah, well that's one, but another important one?
Well, this one you always receive the acknowledgement.
Yeah, well, besides, but in the sense of a structural behavior of this thing, what is this? So we did a certain number of steps, and then what happened? Nice. It's periodic, right? It's called periodic or schedulable Peterinet. You go back to the initial state, right? And so then you repeat, right? And so this one is representing an okay behavior because it repeats itself forever, right? And so it's live, it's bounded, right? And doesn't have a deadlock. So this is a nice Peterinet. And so now the producer and consumer problem, it's an interesting one. You know, you have a guy who produces stuff and then it writes into a buffer and then the consumer does whatever. So now we have done this step, sequencing. Now the producer is ready to send a token to the buffer. Boom. Now, what can we do now? How many transitions are enabled? Two transitions, right? So the consumer can read the buffer and do something with it, or the producer can produce another token. Now, is this guy live? Of course it is, right? It can keep on going all the way, right? Is it bounded? No. Why? Because if producer keeps on going and the consumer does nothing, then the buffer overflows, right? Which is a typical case when you have a slow process and you have a fast process, you don't have enough memory, right? And this is so you need some kind of what is called back pressure. Now, what how would you implement a back pressure on this buffer? Assume that the buffer can take up to 6 tokens, and then there, right? You die. Now, how would you represent a Peternet that says that this thing is cannot go on beyond the 6 tokens? You can generate a, when this is 6, it generates a token, and this token it generates a transition that inhibits that guy to go on, right? And so until the 6 tokens are eaten up, or one of the 6 tokens is eaten up, the producer has got to stop. Which is exactly what happens, right? In the generating new communication protocols, this is exactly what happens. And that is called back pressure. Why is it called back pressure? Because you tell back, I'm full guy, don't write to me, otherwise there is going to be an overwriting of data, so stop it. Now the back pressure is implemented everywhere. Now it may, it may be wasteful because you have to implement all the decision parts that generate the back pressure, but it's the only way to make this thing to be bounded, right? So there is a way of making it work. So okay, so this is exactly what we say, you know, plot, 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 plot. So these are all the possible behaviors that you can generate. Now, this one is similar to what I told you, is imposing that a particular behavior of the system in such a way that things don't go bananas, is what is called the inhibitor arc. And you have this dotted line that says that consumer B can consume only if the buffer A is empty. If it's not empty, it blocks everything. So they don't do anything, and the system goes into deadlock. That's another potential use of this thing. Okay, properties. So behavior depends on the initial marking, of course. Right? It depends on the initial state. So I can have a deadlock, or deadlock free according to the initial distribution. I can have a live net if I have a distribution rather than another, and so on. So, like a finite state machine, like what is the initial state, like in a ordinary differential equation, still the same. Any dynamical system behavior depends on the initial state. So we can talk about reachability, boundedness. See, reachability, we say, can I get to that particular marking set? You know, can I get to that transition? Boundedness, do I generate tokens forever? Schedulability, which means can I find an order in which I can fire the various transitions? Liveness, is this thing alive? And the last one we have not seen. It's called conservation. But it's easy, like for example the case of the unknowledged, transmitted unknowledged is a conservation Peternet, is a conservative Peternet. Why? Why it's conservative? Because we go back to the initial state, and the initial state has got 2 tokens, and at the end of the process, we have 2 tokens, right? So it's conservation of the number of tokens. Always 2 tokens going around. No more than 2 tokens. So the number of tokens is conserved.
So is that true for all periodic?
Not necessarily, no, because I can have, at some point I can have 20 tokens, and then I get 10, then I get 2, right? It depends on the consumer and so on. Conserve means that all the tokens are always the same. So I started with 5 tokens, every transition I still have 5. You know, so I can have a periodic that is not conservative. Now, the behavioral properties depend on the initial condition, so we said it's very interesting. But then there are structural properties that you want to assess no matter what the initial condition is. Certain things do occur or do not occur. Okay, so these are called structural because it depends on the topology independent of the initial marking. Okay, reachability. So what does that mean? So marking M is reachable from marking M0, there exists a sequence of firings so that that you get M from M0. So, interesting enough, the reachability problem is decidable. Hallelujah. So, it's interesting, right? So, okay. Now, how are we going to solve this problem? Well, one way is that we fire all the possible transitions, all the possible sequences, and blah, 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 and we get to the, and we get to see if we reach that particular marking I'm interested in. And so that's the reason why it's decidable. It's a finite number of potential transitions, so that's what, then I can decide in finite time what happens. Now, doesn't mean that you have it in polynomial time. It can be an exponential time, but it is decidable. Okay. So liveness. Liveness is that from any marking, any transition can become fireable. So liveness, of course, implies deadlock freedom, but I can have a deadlock-free thing that is not, that has a transition that is not live. So this particular transition is not live. Why? Because it's executed only once and then forget it. Why? Because I get this transition, I get to that node, that transition is enabled, you get the token there, then that transition up there is enabled, then you get here, then you can cycle through this four, but this four guys gets executed only once. Right? So the transition here, this guy here, is not alive. This is periodic, you know, but it's periodic up to a point. You don't come back to the initial condition, right? You cycle through a different marking than was given at the beginning. Now, of course, this is a very simple case, just to introduce the concept. So, both. And this one, by the way, was deadlock free because the patternet was keeping on going, right? Boundedness, we said before, is the number of tokens in any place cannot grow indefinitely. One bounded, which means that you have in any one place one token, is also called safe patternet. And so you want to check if there is an overflow of buffers. That's a typical property that you want to do, like we discussed before. So this one is unbounded because, of course, you keep on generating tokens that go into that node over there. So the conservation property says that the total number of tokens in the net is constant, always 5. Right? In this particular case, not constant because we'll see that we have at this point we have 3 tokens. Then we do the next one and we got 2. Right? And so this is not conservative. And this is instead is conservative because we'll see that these 3 tokens keep on going. Well, if you execute this a number of times, you'll see that no matter what, there are 3 tokens always in the net itself. So you have 2 tokens here. These guys generate 2 tokens, so 1 token goes there and 1 token goes there. This is enabled, so you get always 3 tokens, no matter how you do it. If you take this path, if you take this path, there is no way in which you can kill a token or you can generate 1 more token. So this one is conservative. Now, interesting enough, it's the same structure in the same pattern net with different marking, which again points out to the fact that the initial marking is fundamental about the property of a pattern net itself. So one can be conservative with an initial marking and not with another one. Okay, so this is the last thing that we're going to say. Tomorrow morning we're going to talk about more about patternet. So there are structural analysis techniques, which means that you look at the structure of the patternet without looking at the initial marking, and you can decide things that related to that machine. Another one, which is instead depending on the initial state and on the initial marking, and they are called state space analysis techniques that are related to the coverability tree and the reachability graph. That is what we were talking about before. How do you describe the behaviors? And you can describe the behavior by looking at how the markings go. So what are the various states that I can generate into the patternet? And that's called reachability graph. So the first one with structural analysis techniques is amazingly simple. It's based on algebraic techniques. It's all based on the ranks of matrices and matrix multiplication, amazingly enough. Similar to what we have seen in the case of data flow. Remember, we had the incidence matrix wave transition by looking at the incidence matrix, and we could determine properties of data flow by looking at the rank of matrices. The same thing here, you know, because this, after all, is a generalization of both finite state machines and data flow. So some of the things that we did in data flow apply here as well. Right? Okay. Tomorrow. Now, interestingly enough, Petri nets are probably more used in operational research and in computer science than in electrical engineering. So you don't use Petri nets to design circuits, but you do use Petri nets to design allocation sequencing. And there's been very interesting work in logistics for defense. So where you want to send your bombs and food and stuff to keep the soldiers okay. Yeah. Sorry, I block you. Ah, si, si, si.